This talk will be about ghosts, higher derivative ghosts, to be precise. The plan of the talk is as follows. First, I shall explain why higher derivative terms in the action are necessary in quantum gravity, though not in Yang-Mills theory. Second, I shall show why higher derivatives appear to give rise to ghosts, states with negative norm. The existence of ghosts would mean that the set of all states would not form a Hilbert space with a positive definite metric. There would not be a unitary S matrix, and there would apparently be states with negative probabilities. These seemed sufficient reasons to dismiss any quantum field theory, such as Einstein gravity, that had higher derivative quantum corrections and ghosts. However, I shall show that one can still make sense of higher derivative theories as a set of rules for calculating probabilities for observations. But one cannot prepare a system in a state with a negative norm, nor can one resolve a state into its positive and negative norm components. So there are no negative probabilities and no non-unitary S matrix. Unitarity is restored in the limit that the higher derivative terms go to zero. The first and second parts of the talk are standard folklore, but I repeat them here because they have largely been forgotten. The third part, living with ghosts, is new as far as I know. I shall assume that quantum field theory is defined by a path integral evaluated in Euclidean space and then Wick rotated to Lorentzian spacetime. In standard, second-order theory, the Lagrangian is a function of the fields in their first derivatives and is quadratic in the first derivatives. One calculates the path integral by perturbation theory. One splits the action into two parts. One part contains quadratic terms in the fields in their first derivatives, and is regarded as the free field action. The remaining terms in the action are regarded as interactions. One then calculates Feynman diagrams using the interactions as vertices and the propagator defined by the free part of the action. This is equivalent to calculating the expectation value of the interactions in the Gaussian measure defined by the free action. One would therefore expect perturbation theory to make sense when and only when the interaction action is bounded by the free action. This is borne out by the examples we know. The free action of a field phi is the volume integral of phi squared plus gradient phi squared. In two dimensions, the free action bounds the pointwise value of phi. Thus it also bounds the volume integral of any entire function of phi. This means that the free action bounds any interaction action, so perturbation theory should work. Indeed, one finds that in two dimensions, any quantum field theory is renormalizable. In four dimensions, on the other hand, the free action does not bound the pointwise value of phi, but only the volume integral of phi to the fourth. This means that the free action bounds the interactions only for theories with quartic interactions, like lambda phi to the four, or Yang-Mills. Indeed, these are the quantum field theories that are renormalizable in four dimensions. Note that even Yang-Mills is not renormalizable in dimensions higher than four, because the interactions are not bounded by the free action. Similarly, Bornenfeld is not renormalizable in dimensions higher than two. When one does perturbation theory for gravity, one writes the metric as G0 plus delta G, where G0 is a background metric, that is a solution of the field equations. One takes the terms quadratic and delta G to be the free action, and the higher order terms to be the interactions. The interactions include terms like gradient delta G squared multiplied by powers of delta G. The volume integral of such an interaction is not bounded by the free action. Thus, perturbation theory breaks down for gravity, which is not renormalizable. Even if all the higher loop divergence is cancelled by some miracle, in a supergravity theory, one couldn't trust the results, because one is using perturbation theory beyond its limit of validity. Delta G can be much larger than G0 locally, for only a small free action. In other words, there are large metric fluctuations below the Planck scale. The situation is different, however, if one adds curvature square terms to the Einstein-Hilbert action, integral R. The action is now quadratic in second derivatives of delta G. One takes the free action to be the quadratic terms in delta G and its first and second derivatives. This bounds the pointwise value of delta G. Thus the free action bounds the interactions and perturbation theory works. This is reflected in the fact that the R plus R squared theory is renormalizable and in fact asymptotically free. However, it has ghosts, as I shall now explain, which have been thought to be a fatal flaw in any quantum field theory. This brings me to the second part of my talk, to show why higher derivative theories have ghosts. Although gravity is a physically interesting case, I shall talk about a scalar field model, which has the same ghostly behavior, but doesn't have the complications of indices, or gauge invariants. The action is shown on the screen. The free action is the product of two scalar wave operators with different masses. I have included a phi to the fourth interaction, but I shall largely ignore it. By acting on phi with the two wave operators, one can define two fields, psi 1 and psi 2. The fourth order free action for phi can then be written as the difference between the free actions for psi 1 and psi 2. Note that the action of psi 2 has the wrong sign, which should raise alarm bells. Classically, it means that the energy of the psi 2 field is negative, while that of psi 1 is positive. If there were no interaction term, this negative energy wouldn't matter. Each of the fields, psi 1 and psi 2, would live in its own world, and the two worlds would not communicate with each other. However, if there is an interaction term, like phi to the fourth, it will couple psi 1 and psi 2 together. Energy can flow from one to the other, and one can have a runaway solution, with the positive energy of psi 1 and the negative energy of psi 2, both increasing exponentially. In quantum theory, on the other hand, one is in trouble even in the absence of interactions, as can be seen by looking at the free field propagator for phi. In momentum space, this is the inverse of a fourth order expression in P. Using partial fractions, one can expand it as the difference between two second-order propagators, which you can recognize as the propagators for psi 1 and psi 2. The important point is, the propagator for psi 2 appears with a negative sign. This would mean that states with an odd number of psi 2 particles would have a negative norm. In other words, psi 2 particles are ghosts. There wouldn't be a positive definite Hilbert space metric, nor a unitary S matrix. If there weren't any interactions, the situation wouldn't be too serious. The state space would be the direct sum of two Hilbert spaces, one with positive definite metric, and the other negative. There wouldn't be any physically realized operators that connected the two Hilbert spaces, so ghost number would be conserved by a super selection rule. A phi to the fourth interaction, however, would allow psi 2 particles to be created or destroyed. As in the classical theory, there will be instabilities with runaway production of psi 1 and psi 2 particles. These instabilities show up in the fact that interactions tend to shift the ghost poles in the two-point function for phi into the complex p-plane, where they represent exponentially growing and decaying modes. This completes the second part of the talk, and it seems to add up to a pretty damning indictment of higher derivative theories in general, and quantum gravity and quantum supergravity, in particular. However, I have always felt it ought to be possible to make sense of a higher derivative field theory. If you do the path integral over all psi 1 and psi 2, the theory looks pretty sick. The path integral over psi 1 will converge. This is because the free action for psi 1 is positive definite. On the other hand, the path integral over psi 2 will diverge because the free action for psi 2 is negative definite. However, it is wrong to do the path integrals over psi 2 and 2 separately because they are not independent fields. They are both determined by phi. The fourth order free action for phi is positive definite. This means the path integral over all phi in Euclidean space will converge and will define a well-determined Euclidean quantum field theory. This Euclidean quantum field theory doesn't obey the reflection positivity conditions. These conditions would ensure that when one analytically continues to Minkowski space, the space of states has a positive definite Hilbert space metric. In classical second-order theory, a state can be defined by its Cauchy data on a space-like surface. This is the values of phi and phi dot on the surface. One can regard this as the position of the field and its conjugate momentum in a canonical 3 plus 1 treatment. In quantum theory, position and momentum don't commute. This means that one cannot specify both the position of the field and its momentum, that is, both the value of phi and that of phi dot. Instead, one describes a state by a wave function in either position space or momentum space. In ordinary quantum mechanics, the position and momentum representations are regarded as equivalent. One is just the Fourier transform of the other. However, with path integrals, one has to use wave functions in the position representation, that is, wave functions that are functionals of phi, rather than phi dot, on a space-like surface. One can see this as follows. Imagine using the path integral to go from a state at T1 to a state at T2, and then to a state at T3. In the position representation, the amplitude to go from a field phi1 on T1 to phi2 at T2 is given by a path integral over all fields phi with the given boundary values. Similarly, the amplitude to go from phi2 at T2 to phi3 at T3 is given by another path integral. These amplitudes obey a composition law. The amplitude to go from phi1 to phi3 is the amplitude to go from phi1 to phi2 times the amplitude to go from phi2 to phi3 integrated over all phi2. The amplitudes obey the composition law because one can join a field from phi1 to phi2 to a field from phi2 to phi3 to obtain a field from phi1 to phi3. In general, phi dot will be discontinuous at T2. However, the field will still have a well-defined action, which will be the sum of the actions from phi1 to phi2, and from phi2 to phi3. On the other hand, if one uses a momentum representation and wave functions in terms of phi dot, the composition law would no longer hold. In general, phi would now be discontinuous at T2, which would make the action infinite. Thus, in second-order theories, one should use wave functions in terms of phi, rather than phi dot. I shall now turn to the fourth-order theory. Classically, a state is determined by the values of phi and its first three time derivatives on a space-like surface. In a canonical treatment, phi and phi double dot are usually taken to be independent coordinates. Then phi dot is the momentum conjugate to phi double dot, and phi triple dot is the momentum conjugate to phi. This suggests that in quantum theory, one should describe a state by a wave functional of phi and phi double dot on the surface. Indeed, this is closely related to using the fields psi1 and psi2 I introduced earlier. These were linear combinations of phi and box phi. Thus, taking the wave function to depend on psi1 and psi2 is equivalent to it depending on phi and phi double dot. One gets in trouble, however, with the composition law if one does the path integral between fixed values of phi and phi double dot. Because the values of phi dot on the intermediate surface, T2, are not constrained, phi dot will be discontinuous at T2. Thus phi double dot will have a delta function on T2 when one joins the phi fields above and below T2. In the second order action, phi double dot appears linearly. Thus the delta function can be integrated by parts, and the action of the combined field will be finite. But phi double dot appears squared in the fourth order action. Thus the action of the combined field would be infinite if phi double dot was a delta function. One can see, therefore, that one should take the wave function to depend on phi and phi dot in order to get the composition law for amplitudes in the fourth order theory. This is one of the key ideas of this talk. The fourth order action for phi is positive definite. Thus it gives a well-defined Euclidean quantum field theory. In this theory, one can calculate the amplitude to go from a state phi1, phi1 dot, at time t1, to a state phi2, phi2 dot, at time t2. In particular, one can calculate the ground state wave function, the amplitude to go from zero field in the infinite Euclidean past, up to the given values of phi and phi dot, at t equals zero. This path integral is Gaussian for the free action, and can be done exactly. Thus the free field ground state wave function is some normalizing factor times e to minus the action of the classical solution from the infinite past up to t equals zero. Similarly, one can calculate the Euclidean conjugate ground state wave function, the amplitude to go from the given value set t equals zero to zero field in the infinite Euclidean future. This conjugate wave function is equal to the original ground state wave function with the opposite sign of phi dot. The probability of quantum fluctuation in the ground state gives the specified values of phi and phi dot on a space-like surface is the ground state wave function multiplied by the Euclidean conjugate wave function. This means it is proportional to e to the minus positive coefficients times the squares of phi and phi dot. The probability dies off at large values of phi and phi dot and is normalizable. Thus, the probability distribution in the Euclidean theory is reasonable. However, if one wick rotates to Minkowski space, phi dot squared picks up a minus sign. The probability distribution becomes unbounded for large Lorentzian phi dot and can't be normalized. This is another reflection of the same sickness as the ghosts. You can't fully determine a state on a space-like surface, because that would involve specifying phi and Lorentzian phi dot, and that doesn't have a physically reasonable probability distribution. Although one cannot define a probability distribution for phi and Lorentzian phi dot on a space-like surface, one can calculate a probability distribution for phi alone by integrating out over Euclidean phi dot. Since the probability distribution is damped at large values of Euclidean phi dot, this integral will converge and give a normalizable probability distribution for phi on a surface. This is just what one would calculate in a second order theory. So the moral is, a fourth order theory can make sense in Lorentzian space if you treat it like a second order theory. In a second order theory, a state can be described by a wave function that depends on the values of phi on a space-like surface. Thus, the amplitude to go from an initial state is given by a path integral from phi 1 on t1 to phi 2 on t2. To calculate the probability to go from the initial state to the final, one multiplies the amplitude by its Euclidean conjugate. This can be represented as a path integral from a third surface, T3, back to T2. Thus one has a double-decker sandwich in Euclidean space. One now analytically continues T2 to future infinity in Minkowski space, and T1 and T3 to past infinity, keeping their Euclidean time values fixed. This gives the Minkowski space probability to go from an initial state to a final state. Because the path integral in a second-order theory depends only on phi on the boundary, what happens outside the sandwich doesn't matter. Furthermore, the path integrals above and below T2 can be calculated independently. This means the probability to go from initial to final can be factorized into the product of an S matrix and its adjoint. The S matrix is unitary because probability is conserved. Now consider calculating the probability to go from initial to final in a fourth order theory. Again, one has a three-layer sandwich. However, the path integral now depends on both phi and phi dot on the boundary. As I just showed, we can observe phi dot Lorentzian because it has an unbounded probability distribution. The best one can do is take phi dot to be continuous on the surfaces and integrate over all values. One fixes only the values of phi on the surfaces. In this setup, one cannot calculate the path integrals above and below T2 independently because they both depend on phi dot on T2. This means the probability to go from initial to final does not factorize into an S matrix and its adjoint. Instead, there is loss of quantum coherence because one cannot observe all the information that characterizes the final state. I should say there is no obvious connection between this loss of quantum coherence and the possible loss in black hole evaporation. Another consequence of the dependence of the path integral on phi dot is that what goes on outside the sandwich now affects the result. The most natural choice would be the vacuum state above and below the sandwich. That is, one takes the path integral to be over all fields that have the given values on the three surfaces, and that go to zero in the infinite Euclidean future and past. This choice of boundary conditions is not symmetric between the initial and final states. However, I think I can show that the probability given by the sandwich tends towards that of the second order theory, as the coefficient of the fourth order term in the action tends to zero. This is important because it means that fourth order corrections to graviton scattering can be neglected completely at the low energies that now occur in the universe. On the other hand, in the very early universe, when fourth order terms are important, we expect the Euclidean metric to be some instanton, like a force field. In such a situation, one cannot define scattering or ask about unitarity. The only quantities we have any chance of observing are the endpoint functions of the metric perturbations. These determine the endpoint functions of fluctuations in the microwave background. As Hertog, Riol, and I have shown, the trace anomaly model of inflation can give a sensible spectrum of microwave fluctuations, despite the fact it has fourth order terms and ghosts. The fourth order terms can have important effects in reducing the fluctuations to the level we observe. What about the instabilities I mentioned earlier? Wouldn't even the slightest amount of a fourth order term lead to runaway production of positive and negative energies, or of real and ghost particles? The classical theory is certainly unstable if one prescribes the initial value of phi and its first three time derivatives. However, in quantum theory, every sensible question can be posed in terms of vacuum-to-vacuum amplitudes. These can be defined by Wick rotating to Euclidean space and doing a path integral over all fields that die off in the Euclidean future and past. Thus, the Euclidean formulation of a quantum field theory implicitly imposes a final boundary condition that the fields remain bounded. This final boundary condition removes the instabilities and runaways, like a final boundary condition removes the runaway solution of the classical radiation reaction force. The price one pays for removing runaways with a final boundary condition is a slight violation of causality. For example, with the classical radiation reaction force, a particle would start to accelerate before a wave hit it. However, one could never detect a violation of causality in quantum gravity, because the warping of the light cones produces an infinite time delay, at least in four dimensions. I hope I have shown you that quantum gravity with fourth order corrections can make sense, despite apparently having negative energy solutions and ghosts. In doing this, I seem to have gone against the convictions of the last 25 years that unitarity and causality were essential requirements of any viable theory of quantum gravity. Perturbative string theory has unitarity and causality, so it has been claimed as the only viable quantum theory of gravity. But even the most ardent advocate of string theory would not claim that it gave the whole picture. The string perturbation expansion does not converge, and string theory has to be augmented by non-perturbative objects, like D-brains. The world sheet theory of D-brains with P greater than 1 has similar non-renormalizability problems to Einstein gravity and supergravity. Thus string theory effectively has ghosts, though this awkward fact is quietly glided over. One might object that if one can live with ghosts, there would be no way to fix the renormalized parameters, and there would be no need for supersymmetry or M-theory. I share those concerns. The network of dualities that go under the name of M-theory is so beautiful, it can't just be an accident. It must be telling us about the universe we live in. On the other hand, I know from my work on the Cauchy problem that you need higher derivatives to do perturbation theory for gravity in more than two dimensions. Two-dimensional metrics are conformally flat. That means the perturbations don't change the light cone. This is why one can have a world sheet theory of strings without higher derivatives, but not of higher dimensional brains. Still, we live either on a three brain or in the bulk of a higher dimensional compactified space. Thus higher derivatives, and their accompanying ghosts, are necessary for perturbation theory. But maybe the dualities of M-theory imply one can do the perturbation calculations with the higher derivatives and obtain a smooth limit when the higher derivative terms in the action are taken to zero. To recap on what I have said, I showed that perturbation theory for gravity in dimensions greater than 2 required higher derivatives in the free action. Higher derivatives seem to lead to ghosts, states with negative norm. To analyze what was happening, I considered a fourth order scalar field theory. I showed the path integral required that quantum states be specified by the values of phi and phi dot on a space-like surface, rather than phi and phi double dot, as is usually done. The wave function over phi and phi dot is bounded in Euclidean space, but grows exponentially with Minkowski space phi dot. This means one cannot observe phi dot, but only phi. One therefore has to trace out over phi dot on the final surface, and lose information about the quantum state. However, one can never produce a negative norm state, or get a negative probability. The departures from unitarity will be very small at low energies. The higher derivative terms will be important in the early universe, but their unitarity cannot be defined. Thus one can live quite happily with ghosts. Indeed, now that we have outlawed every other form of discrimination, it is time to abandon our racial prejudice against ghosts. Some of my best friends are ghosts.
The usual identification of moments and memento in order to get this description. and hybrid groups are not going to work in most doses. For example, if I take what I'm doing,
I take the path integral to be fundamental, not a canonical formulation. The canonical formulation would not give the right composition law.
If I think about this graphically, naively there's a vertex in which two gravitons scatter into a graviton plus a ghost. So I'm not sure exactly what the description is, but have you, for example, calculated explicitly three-body to three-body scattering at tree level, where you have an intermediate state that could be a ghost or a graviton, and seen from this calculation that it has all the properties that you want: conservation of probability, unitarity, cluster decomposition. So that would be just a tree graph with two vertices in it.
I haven't done that yet. But we are quite used dealing with fatty top of ghosts and Feynman diagrams. I don't see why we can't find rules for dealing with higher derivative ghosts.
Sounds like a good starting point for further discussion. In the meantime, let's thank Stephen again.